Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Dr. Nick, the Incrementalist. Join me as I seek out the small incremental changes being applied in other industries that we can learn from and that can be applied in healthcare. Can these changes bring immediate value, but also add up to the big improvements and revolution we need in healthcare? Come along with me to explore the possibilities. My innovative guests from around the globe have used small incremental improvements to achieve their moonshot.
And today, I'm delighted to be joined by Stacy Chang. He is the executive director and founder of the Design Institute for Health, and also a professor at the Dell Medical School and College of Fine Arts. Stacy, thanks for joining me today.
Nick, very much my pleasure.
So for the benefit of the listeners, I always like to start with a little bit of an introduction with your background. You have truly a fascinating and very unusual background in the healthcare space, and one that, you know, the first time we met was totally intriguing to me. Could you share a little bit of that and, you know, some of the things that led you to this point and, you know, moving to Austin?
Yeah, absolutely. I don't know how fascinating it is. It is unusual, that's for sure. I am trained as an engineer, actually, and only came to design by way of a firm I worked for a number of times, actually, over the course of my career. So a company called IDEO, which I was the first intern for some 25 years ago in Boston, Massachusetts. Through that company, I discovered design and all that it eventually came to be over the course of, you know, a couple of decades. You know, design, I think, was relegated to something more akin to aesthetics, you know, when I first started. And then it changed quite dramatically in both its practice and then in its import to a number of industries over the course of the last few decades. I returned to IDEO in 2005 and worked as the project leader and eventually took over parts and then all of the healthcare practice for the firm globally. And so that work really was the culmination of my career there up until 2014. So what was a practice that focused mostly on medical devices ended up spending most of its time working on large, complex systems in the health and healthcare system, everything from consumer products and interventions to care models for hospitals and healthcare systems to government, pharma, insurance. We touched pretty much everything. That was fantastic for someone with undiagnosed ADD. That I was working on something different almost every couple months,
right?
All the time. But it was also fantastic education in the broad ecosystem of health and healthcare. So I enjoyed that immensely. And in that time, came to know a gentleman named Clay Johnston, who's the dean of the Dell Medical School here at the University of Texas at Austin. And we ended up working on some really large scale things, everything from establishing a foundation for precision medicine, which was just arising at the time, to working on healthcare policy and cost transparency in the state of California. So those things became the vernacular between Clay and I, applying design to large scale, complex issues that needed significant change. And in 2014, I departed IDEO, and about a week later, Clay called me and said, "Hey, I'm doing this interesting thing in Austin. Let me tell you a little bit about the circumstances." And he started describing all these pretty fantastical circumstances, actually, that gave rise to an opportunity essentially to develop from first principles a model for a modern health system. And it sounded a little bit ridiculous, honestly. And I told Clay, I was like, "Nothing sounds that good. Nothing is that good." He said, "Well, come down and visit and have a look." And so I did. And a couple months later, we announced the Design Institute. Really, the basis for it was that he said to me, "You know, you've spent a career trying to apply design to the edges of the dysfunction. You're not getting a chance to do what I know you really want to do, which is apply design and some really creative problem-solving techniques to the creation of a system as a whole. Here's your opportunity." And that's hard to say no to.
You know, it's funny you bring up that story because it reminds me from one of mine many years ago. And it was a very similar experience. It was this sort of call out of the blue. "Hey, would you be interested?" I said, "Yeah, but not really. You know, as a courtesy, I'll come along, don't want to mislead you." And, you know, came away with this huge problem going, "Wow, this is just too good to miss." It sounds very similar to that, you know, suddenly you got, I don't want to say the world, but an opportunity that just doesn't come along too many times in a person's career.
No, that's very much right. I always hesitate to invoke the notion of once in a lifetime, but it really did seem like a once in a lifetime opportunity. It's not it's very unusual, certainly in the U.S. system, to have an opportunity to establish a new medical school, to build a new regional health system with a different funding mechanism, and essentially to consider what it means to actually deliver health and healthcare for a community and a society.
And I think it's important to note, if my recollection is correct, that in this particular instance, whilst there was obviously a generous donation from the Michael and Susan Dell Foundation to help sort of jumpstart this, the predominant funding mechanism was taxation that the local population said, we vote to increase for this benefit. Is that true?
That's exactly right. And that's really, I think, the component that makes this most unique. In 2012, voters in Travis County voted a tax measure into place, which increased their portion of their property taxes by 63%, which is dedicated to care for the underserved. And that generates, I think, about $100 million annually to create a care model for those who are not insured in the state of Texas, or at least in Travis County. And then $35 million of that goes to the Dell Medical School every year to support the creation and ongoing service that the medical school provides to the community.
It's fantastic. I mean, it's just delightful to hear about those kind of things, because it, you know, this happens to be one of those odd days where, you know, it's pay it forward, you know, random acts of kindness. And it's funny how those kindness things cascade out. And I'm sure you've sort of felt that through the course of this. You're now 4 years on at Dell Medical School. You've had the opportunity to see the development each year and expand the cohort. Tell us a little bit about that before we get into the Design Institute, if you could.
Yeah, the students arrived in the summer of 2015. That was the first class, and that means they will be graduating this coming summer. So our fourth year medical students are headed into the residency match in a short amount of time here, and then they'll be off to wherever they go. So it'll be, I think, exciting to see their impact out in the world. It's a little bit of a, like you said, it's definitely a long-term pay-it-forward effort. You know, these students who've been now with us for 4 years will move on to the residencies, and then we hope become the physician leaders that they train to be here, ones that are comfortable with uncertainty and eager to lead the change that absolutely has to happen.
No better way for widespread impact than actually taking it at source and then spreading it out so that you now sort of seed out into, let's hope they all move out. Well, not all. I obviously want, you know, many of them to stay in Austin and deliver the value back, but let's hope some of them will take some of that initiative and bring it out to the rest of the community around the United States.
We hope so. Well, if their interviews are any suggestion, they are an, I would say, hot, but at least interesting commodity. Having been trained very, very differently, I think the systems that are interviewing them are recognizing that they are a very different breed of medical student.
Fantastic. There was an announcement recently that, from my perspective, really sort of piqued my interest. I've obviously been tracking this and you and Clay's activities and you know, had the privilege of meeting some of these med students, but you essentially announced a whole new degree program or study program. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, I'm happy to. I'll have to give you a little bit of history because it almost makes no sense out of context. When we arrived at the Dell Medical School, the Design Institute for Health, which is the institute that I run, was and remains a relatively unusual entity, taking the capabilities and the perspectives of design and applying it to a broad challenge in health and the health ecosystem. And so that combined with a fairly unique curriculum and for the med school students in at Dell Medical School, they actually have all of their classroom and laboratory learning condensed into the first year. They do their clinical rotations on their second year, and their third year is actually entirely opened up for a year where they can pursue additional knowledge and training that will make them more than just clinical leaders. It'll make them what we hope leaders in their field. And they can get a degree, a master's degree. They can get They can get a master's degree in healthcare transformation. They can get a biomedical engineering degree. They can get a master's in public health. And those students, a significant number of them asked, well, those slight oddballs that sit up on the eighth floor, over in the Design Institute are interesting because we hang out with them as well in this third year. And we had not intended to teach. There was a lot of work for us to do. I remember distinctly telling Clay, I was like, I'm not coming here to teach. We're here to execute on new models of care. And he said, well, they want to hang out with you. And I said, well, let's ask them how many of them actually want to spend time with us and do they really understand what they might be getting themselves into. And so we asked in the first year, and fully 20% of the students raised their hands and said, we'd be interested in having a conversation with you, at which point we were utterly overwhelmed because we can't take that many students, that's for sure, even if we did. And so in the first 2 years, we actually ran a bit of a prototype of this, which is apropos for design, to see if there was actually something there, if there's something mutually beneficial, one where we could imbue the students with a different approach and thought process and set of skills to problem solve and see if they'd like us. It was successful. We've had two cohorts now of students come through. For many of them has been the most distinct part of their medical school training. And as part of the collaboration with the College of Fine Arts, we recognize, well, there's a need here, not just for medical students, but for many other people, because those classes that we ran actually incurred interest from folks outside of the medical field as well. And so we established this degree, really in response to an ask and a demand from those around us, closely around us in the medical school and in the university, but also from a demand expressed from industry as well.
Fantastic. So for those of you just joining, I'm Dr. Nick, the Incrementalist, and today I'm talking to Stacey Chang, the Executive Director and Founder of the Design Institute for Health. We were just talking about the newly, but it actually sounds like it's 2 years old, but not sort of publicly available. You've sort of now emerged from the shadows, having tested this out. Obviously, 2 years of experience, fascinated to hear what the sort of feedback was, some of the learning opportunities in that. And it sounds like it was highly significant for those individuals that were lucky enough to participate.
Yeah, very much so. I think the most interesting aspects that the students walk away with is a very different view on the world in which they often find themselves immersed. In medical school, you're trained very narrowly to engage with the health system in the way that doctors are meant to, right? We prescribe the way, in the clinics, on the floors, a person-to-person interaction, and they often lack the perspective of the system within which they work. And that system within which they work prescribes so much of what goes on between them and the individuals they interact with each day. And so helping them understand that there are a lot of forces at play and that ultimately they have some influence over them, depending on how they want to engage, helps them understand not only the context of the work they do in the clinics themselves, but potentially how they might shape the space around them. So we teach them some fundamental tenets of design. So, first, do you understand the dynamics that are going on inside the system, both from a system dynamic standpoint, but also at the elemental level, which is at the human level? Most complex social systems, and healthcare is definitely one of them, consists of a lot of irrational humans. We tend to give lip service to the humans we call patients and their families, but there's also another set of humans too, which are all the people who work there, the staff, the providers, people who are actually delivering care. And all of those end up in a giant stew of irrationality around which we build a system that's supposed to deliver one of the most important things we do in society. So we teach them to, like a sociologist or a psychologist or an anthropologist, to better understand the system around them, to have a critical eye and to understand the motivations that underlie all the behavior that actually happens. And then we teach them to view the complexity as a system, to see where they can nudge and make change, measure and make change again in pursuit of a larger goal. We teach them how to prototype, how to develop interventions that can make a change, and how to work with all the stakeholders in the system. So that's in short form the gist of the curriculum. But then they're taught, they're also given an opportunity to delve more deeply into different aspects that interest them. Is it about service? Is it about business components? But most importantly, they end up doing a semester-long project with a corporate or a community partner, where they have an opportunity to practice in real life what it means to do design and to understand what on the ground realities actually look like when you're trying to make change at a large scale. So in the first 2 years, we had them do work with local EMS service, trying to understand what a community health paramedic might actually look like. We had them work with the local YMCA to understand what it means to actually fulfill a prescription for exercise, which is one that doctors write all the time but don't know how to fill. And then actually work with a pretty prominent retailer locally to see if they could actually put together an entire suite of health services for their employees to see if they could actually significantly change the health of the employees themselves. So part of the goal is to give them some philosophical and practical grounding, but also for them to experiment as well to see really how design manifests when it's practiced.
So you talk about some of these, you know, major aspects to design and design thinking, and specifically going back to sort of drivers of behavior, you know, and I listen to you and I think about sort of the irrationality of people's behavior and how we overcome that. As you sort of look back at the past experiences, were there any sort of key insights that some of the students perhaps got that really sort of changed them, their way of thinking about healthcare and the way that they deliver it to their patients?
Yeah, I think there are a few insights that arose quite consistently. You know, one of the most, maybe it's blindingly obvious when we say it this way, but it's not ever in the moment where patients are considering the therapies that they need to engage with. You know, it's not as if any of the patients don't understand what a more healthy lifestyle looks like. You know, every smoker knows that they should stop smoking.
Right.
But it's almost in spite of that knowledge that they're unable to act. And the most difficult part is that it's not the healthcare or the health-seeking behavior that's unknown. It's that the hurdles in front of them that get them to a point where that's their first priority is really the issue. You know, we've had patients tell us, yeah, I don't make my chemotherapy appointments because every time I do, I miss a half day of work, and I miss another half day of work, and I'm going to lose my job, and then my children will have no food. So yeah, no, my chemotherapy appointment does not matter more than taking care of my kids. And so you see a lot of these life circumstances arise, and you recognize then that the determinants, as we often call them, of health, have often very little to do with the quality of care and the access to care that most of the patients need. And so addressing those first and foremost, first acknowledging them, which the system rarely does, and then assisting them where they need it, can make a huge difference. Even the token gesture of acknowledging them allows people to feel like the system is on their side as opposed to being against them. So that's a first start. And really that is treating humans like humans, like recognizing that they have their own motivations and their own needs and their own challenges. And so that has been as true for the patients as it has been for the practitioners of care, the staff and the faculty and the providers and the MDs and nurses and all the folks who provide care. They too want to do good work, but oftentimes it's the system requirements that keep them from actually doing it. They will often ascribe to the right thing to do, but in the moment can't achieve it because they've been asked to prioritize something else.
So a lot of this sounds similar to sort of behavioral management and this, you know, the disconnect between a short-term experience and the long-term gain. You know, healthy behavior is a good example of that. You know, that packet of chips or you know, chocolate or whatever doesn't feel as bad because the impact is so far removed. What have they found? I mean, they must have experimented. You know, you talk about some of these hurdles. There must have been some attempts to try and influence that behavior in the short term as part of some of these projects with the YMCA, for example, and the local retailer.
Yeah, I think what you mentioned is critically important, is that when an individual patient, along with their family, and then the care team that's providing them, understand mutually where they're both meant to go, you know, why is the physician prescribing this thing for you? Do we understand what the long-term goal is for collectively all of us? And it really is a team that does include the patient. and their family. You know, you don't solve diabetes in an injection in the clinic. It right. takes a lifetime of change in behavior shifts in food and in the way you socialize and exercise and any number of things to really address that. And so it's really critically important for all of them then to understand, okay, what's the North Star? What's the thing we're actually headed towards? Because then each incremental activity that they, each incremental behavior change that they adopt is actually then understood to be in pursuit of something rather than something that's just prescribed, right? We talk about prescriptions all the time. And unfortunately, right. the connotation of a prescription is that as the authority, me as the doctor, I'm telling you what to do. And it's absent your understanding and doesn't channel your motivation for what you'd like to do. When we collectively understand where we are trying to head, then some of those individual small incremental changes actually make sense to the individual, and they're more likely to adopt them because they've had some say and they have some control in it as well.
You know, it's interesting you bring up that word prescribe, and you know, I focus on sometimes these words that, you know, are historical by nature, but, you know, permeate throughout the healthcare system. And that one hadn't occurred to me, but you're exactly right. It's this here, do this, which is never the pathway to sort of success or influencing behavior. And, you know, it leaves me wondering, perhaps there's a better term. Instead of me writing a prescription, it's me writing some guidance or some supporting. I don't know what it is exactly, but I think that's a central sort of tenet to all of this. It's fascinating.
Yeah, I'll just say the medical field is rife with those terms.
Right.
Prescription. I've never prescribed something to my children that they want to do, but I've often encouraged them to do something that was good for them, and that actually worked out better. But you know, right. you hear that all the time. We talk about medical adherence, which is to say, you know, the system decides something that you should do, and then we measure whether you comply with it. Right? Compliance is another version of that. I think the Brits use concordance. I don't know if that's much better, but there definitely is better terminology. But even beyond that, if the terminology actually suggests the approach, then we should be changing the approach as well.
Fantastic. So we're almost out of time. If you could just perhaps share just a little bit of what you see coming in this exciting sort of launch for the new study opportunity. I think I believe it's not quite open, but how can people learn more? And what are you expecting in this coming year?
Yeah, the applications are actually open. We're accepting them now through May. What we're looking forward to is actually what we've already seen from the applications, and what we expect will continue is a really diverse and broad spectrum of individuals, certainly medical students, of which we have some, but also folks from industry, some who are coming back to school after having spent a career in healthcare or in adjacent healthcare fields, folks who are trying to enter into healthcare from a very different vantage point, and then students who are motivated to make change in something as meaningful as health and healthcare, but want to do it from a different vantage point with a different skill set. You know, I think the things that we see is that you know, evidence-based, which we talk a lot about in healthcare, is important, but creativity is as well. Right, because the future has no evidence about it. There's no data about the future just yet. And so if you rely on evidence only, you'll only be backwards facing. So we look forward to not only a diverse and compelling spectrum of learners and doers, but also to the outcomes that they will manifest in their own careers.
Fantastic. Well, it just remains for me to thank you, Stacey, for joining me. It's always a pleasure to catch up. I always learn something new, interesting, and, you know, quite revelatory in terms of, you know, those closed perceptions that we have as a result of sort of living and breathing this healthcare space. So thanks for joining me on the show.
Always a pleasure. Thanks, Nick.
Thanks for joining me today. Do you have any better ideas, or have you found a small incremental change that's brought about a big improvement in your world? Let's continue the conversation on our hashtag, The Incrementalist, or share with me at DrNick1 on Twitter. You can find more information about the show on our program page at healthcarenowradio.com. And tune in next time to hear my discussions with leaders and innovators from around the globe who've revolutionized their space by using small incremental improvements to achieve their moonshot. I'm Dr. Nick, The Incrementalist, and I'm starting a revolution through evolution.